Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Voices from Room. On this podcast, writers, poets, activists, artists, and analysts who have contributed to Room talk about their work, themselves, and the complex problems our world faces. Room is currently open for submissions until May 5th, 2024. To submit your work and to read more, visit us online at analytic-room.com. My name is Isaac Sloan, and I'm joined by Aneta Stojnic. Hi, Aneta.
Hi, Isaac, and everyone who's listening. It is my great pleasure to welcome our guest today, Betty Tang, who is a psychoanalyst and trauma therapist who has worked with survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, and childhood molestation in Mount Sinai Beth Israel's Victims Services Program in Manhattan. She's one of the authors of the New York Times bestseller, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, and a contributing essayist in Adam Phillips' book, The Cure for Psychoanalysis. In December 2023, a new book she co-edited, Mind of State, Conversations on the Psychological Conflicts Stirring U.S. Politics and Society, compiling conversations from the popular psychopolitical podcast she co-founded and co-hosted, was released by Sherlin Publications. On the faculty on Manhattan Institute for Psychoanalysis Trauma Studies program, and its 1 year program on psychoanalysis in the sociopolitical world, Betty currently sees couples and adults in private practice. And Betty has contributed to Room in multiple ways over time. And we're going to hopefully talk today about all of them. Welcome, Betty.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Aneta and Isaac. It's great to be here and on this side of the microphone.
It feels good for a change.
Yeah, it does.
Betty, I would really like to open up this conversation with reminding our listeners and usually readers of Room as well of your piece in Room, Duty to Speak, which was published all the way back in May 2017. And when I was rereading it for this conversation today, I thought how it could have been written today and how current it is at the moment as we are entering or have just entered the new election year. So can you tell us a little bit about how is that for you?
I mean, Aneta, everything that we've been talking about, particularly with the book that you mentioned from my bio, The Mind of State, Conversations on the Psychological Conflicts During U.S. Politics and Society, we collected those conversations from 2019 through to 2021. So that was at this point in 2024, some time ago. But then even going back to 2017, it feels like we are in a repetitive moment. And in that way, whether we go back 4 years or whether we go back for 2017, 2016, my math is horrible, 8 years, that we are, you know, if in psychodynamic or psychoanalytic ways, we're repeating things. We have not jumped out of, we have not, to use video game terms, because I listened to your last podcast, we have not leveled up. And this is an indication that we are not paying attention to some key things. So that you say that you went back to that piece and found it to be so current, I think speaks to exactly, I mean, things are more entrenched than they were then, but the issues are very much rooted and similar. We're still talking about immigration. We're still talking about identity politics, although they say that the investigators of the political sciences say right wingers are really playing on identity politics. Really, the two sides agree on a lot of policy. So you have to do identity in order to really get your votes in. So things are more polarized. we're dealing with the same candidates as we did back then. You know, in 2016 it was Hillary Clinton and Trump, but this is not going away, and I think it behooves us to see the signal that we have to think about this psychologically as well. So I think that it calls upon us with the skills to do so, to think about politics from different frameworks.
You know, it's so interesting that the podcast is starting here today, because we just last week spoke to Daniel Benveniste about his work, and he was talking about as we move forward in the world, our kind of infant selves always being with us, and how to remember that we have had experiences, we have things to kind of call from that are different than when we were just infants. And, you know, can we remember that rather than repeat something? And how does that help us act in a way that's political rather than kind of frozen or just kind of caught up in fear? And I hear you saying a kind of similar thing around leveling up and what it means to be in a kind of repetition.
Yeah, and I think off of what you're saying, Isaac, there's a crisis state, and you can think of it through a trauma-informed lens, in the sense that if you're not taking yourselves with you, if the continuity is not happening, so therefore past and future are not with you. You're in the moment, in a sense, they're in the moment, which is a, you know, on a adaptive way or a positive way, is mindfulness. But in this moment, this is crisis. You can't think beyond the moment. And I think we have also to look at it that way, so that we can make more space. So, like, the room to speak was about making space to think. We are not in a space that allows us to think. And we've got to think about ways in which we're compromising our space to think, which is all about psychoanalytic and psychodynamic ways of thinking or approaching things and relationships and ourselves. And as well as our collective, and on all different levels, like, technology comes into play here, the media, the news, how we get our information, how we move through time, because in crisis, time doesn't exist in terms of a progression, and it becomes, you know, psychotic.
And the current crisis continues to be
Oh,
perpetuated.
absolutely. Absolutely. We can see all the crises, inclusive of the Hamas and Gaza conflict, starting in October 8th, as a reification or an amplification of Ukraine, of previous to that, Iraq, of Syria. You know, all of the conflicts are repetitive and based on very similar things, as we kind of like to look at in mind of state. What are the bigger movements? What, applying a psychoanalytic approach, what's lying underneath these conflicts? What's happening? You know, we're always asking, what is actually happening? We can apply this to these macro global events as well. Also, the denial of climate change. You know, what is happening? And where are our anxieties?
It's what are our anxieties? And at the same time, there is that question, what did we want that brought us here, that landed us here? What did we unconsciously desired?
And what did we not want to look at?
Yeah.
What did we dissociate? What do we still not want to look at? And we can go to one of the guests we had was Pauline Boss, who talks about ambiguous loss, and she coined a phrase that I just love to repeat because it's so true, saying about the United States as being a nation founded upon unresolved loss or unresolved trauma. So if you don't want to look at it, it's going to keep happening. This is sort of basic 101 trauma-informed treatment or psychodynamic treatment. These are the principles. If we don't look at it, it will keep cycling. It will repeat. So what are the things we don't want to look at, inclusive of what are the things we prefer to look at? How are those things blocking us from what we need to look at maybe, but it's too painful to do so.
Maybe, like what you're talking about now kind of connects to one of your other contributions to Room, which was the interview that you and Brent did with Anton Hart
Anton.
about radical openness. And I don't know, I'm the kind of person who tries to be hopeful even in darkest of times, and I'm thinking that maybe this concept of radical openness is something that can be really hopeful.
I think so too. I mean, I think that Anton's use of radical openness, which I, will badly paraphrase or represent here, but I've been thinking about his concept of radical openness a lot recently in terms of this polarization. And this is partly why we had him on the podcast, which is, he's really talking about in sessions in the treatment room, how do we take in the other as if into our care, which is how I take in Anton's concept, and let their reflections about us and on us be take them very seriously. So even if they say, of course he makes caveats like racist statements and offensive and hurtful statements are not what you take into your care, but even then, you want to take it seriously, which is to me, I think, founded upon the need to tell the truth and to get at the truth, which, is a diverse and multifaceted thing. But to honor that expression and that reflection upon you, of you or of themselves, and to hold it with respect. That's how I interpret it. Like, I mean, and that's not what's happening in this polarization. There is splits, there are binaries, there are us and them dynamics and dichotomies where you assume that the other person and the other side and their views might be noxious, but that there are opposition, our enemy, they're a threat. And I think radical openness encourages us to enter into it, not thinking that the person on the other side, whatever they're coming in with, is a threat. And I'm just sort of talking as we go here, but like I really think that that's important because we can get really fixed, and I'll speak to myself on this. Like I can get very fixed on who and what I am and what I believe. And I think radical openness isn't asking us to sort of understand and using psychoanalytic principles. We don't know who we are. We don't know who, we don't know much of anything. So why don't we take in what's happening and use it rather than assume, which is, the road to bias hell, So it. I agree. It's very, very hopeful. It's challenging. It's really, really challenging.
It's like that line from Hamlet, we know who we are, but not what we may become.
And I think an analyst might say we don't know who we are either.
We think that
We think we know who we are. So, but far be it for us to like argue with Shakespeare.
Hearing this and thinking about the name of the book coming out around the podcast, Mind of State, and thinking about the title as it relates to what we're talking about, and also just curious about it as this is upcoming for you, or I guess it just came out.
Yeah,
So
it's
if you
out.
wanted to tell us some more about it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it had its sort of surprising, its own surprising path, and to the point of Anita saying, like the piece that I wrote, Room to Speak, could have been written right now. We had put the podcast to bed. It was great to do. It was a lot of work, so I understand for you, where you guys are at in terms of how much work it is, and we felt like we wanted to take it through the 2020 election. And as it ended up happening, we took it through the January 6th siege, which we didn't know was happening, and the impeachment trial, I believe, happened also right around then. And then we were done. But then my partner, Tom Singer, who is a Jungian analyst, was reviewing some transcripts for some other project, and he said, "You know, these are still relevant." And this was now with the book. We took 2023 to edit the whole thing, 29 transcripts. So this is fall of 2022. And he said, "These are still evergreen." And we picked thematic topics because we wanted to think about topics like race in America, or truth, or freedom of speech, or polarization, meaning the identity politics. What creates a bias? What creates one of our episodes, "Why Does Everybody Hate the Jews?" Like, we really were looking at the roots of discrimination. And so in a way, we designed it to be relevant beyond its time, but he was really thinking about it and saying this could be useful. So we took the time, and as we edited them, because all the episodes, as you guys experienced, were not designed to come one after the other. They were sort of happenstantial, and we talked to who was available when we could talk to them. But when we reorganized them along the lines of themes, and we have six themes in the book, anxieties of race and dominance, trauma, truth, loss. We have the myth in politics, and we have democracy at risk, and an intro about the framework, which was based on a Jungian concept of cultural complexes, which is those anxieties that different cultures have that are germane to that culture. So those are the arguments that we made to categorize them in this way. When we reorganized them, we started to see connections. And that really is really what brings it home to me as being effective, because you start to see. So we had a thing on teens and politics, and we interviewed Lisa D'Amore, who's a great child psychologist, and we were talking about the stresses that teens were going through in the Trump era, that discussions over the dinner table, these kinds of stresses. But then we thought about gun control, and then we thought about race relations, and then you start thinking about the reasons for the Buffalo mass shooting, or the synagogue Tree of Life shooting. These are identity mixed with young people, not in the Tree of Life, but definitely in the Buffalo, Uvalde. So these things are starting to come together, and they impact each other. So they're not even climate change. And we interviewed somebody about climate justice, and we look at the pandemic, which was after we or during our recording, but really to think about the pandemic. And race relations. I mean, George Floyd's murder happened in the middle of the 2020 lockdown, and the Black Lives Matter movement, the biggest movement in the history of the United States ever, among any movement, in terms of numbers of people participating and sustained duration of time. This is not an accident. And so we've got to think about these things, and time is happening so quickly. And one of the things my partner Tom said was, we can want to forget. We can want to not look back. We've got to keep moving. And it is an ethos, I will say this about my home country, that we're kind of in a move on culture. Let's just move on. Let's not dwell on it. Let's move on. We got to keep moving. And it's a trauma response. I mean, I'm a trauma therapist, so I see things through a certain lens, but we move on too quickly at our hazard. And I think there are ways in which we're set up to move on without thinking. And if we don't do that, we end up, Anita, like you were saying in the beginning of the conversation, back where we were in 2016. We're literally having the same two political candidates as we did in 2020.
It's the thing that, I think all of us say to our patients in one way or another, like if you just because you say that you don't want to think about something or that you have moved on from something, it doesn't mean that it's not still there and that it's not
Correct.
still making you suffer.
For sure. Absolutely. And if you haven't fully metabolized it, then it is in you somatically. And that will manifest. There's something that I've been really thinking about. Resmaa Menakem is a trauma-informed somatic experience expert. He talks about clean pain and dirty pain. And it's such a useful dichotomy. I use it all the time with patients that dirty pain is the pain of denial, avoidance, and hiding and deception. And it's dirty because if you deal with pain in this manner, there's no growth. You can't do anything with it. It's not there. Clean pain is the pain of talking, meeting, doing the difficult work of confronting these truths within yourself and with others, saying the things you don't want to say, saying the things that you want to say but afraid of offending other people. So it kind of keys back in with radical openness in a way. It's like it's pain either way, but one is growth oriented and generative and truly is going to allow you to move on. Whereas the other one is short-term moving on, maybe, but it's not really moving on, and you're gonna keep rotating. And patients tell us this all the time. Why do I keep doing the same thing? Why do I keep doing this? We say this to ourselves. Why do we keep doing the same thing? Gotta look at that. Why do we, as a culture in the United States, keep doing the same thing?
What is it that we're trying not to forget?
I think that there are certain answers to that in our history that keep repeating, and it's right there for us to see, but we have to acknowledge it. And the truth and reconciliation and the reparations examples in our global history teach us that there are ways to repair. But I think it's something that I don't know. I think we have to prepare ourselves, ready ourselves for that, and recognize that this is creating a noxious cycle.
There's been, I think, two times where there was a little bit of a slip where you called the essay Room to Speak. And of course it appears in Room, and we're talking a lot about how to think in crisis, which is about really making room for thinking and speaking, but it's called Duty to Speak. And there's
Oh,
a
that's
side
really
of the
funny.
there's a side of the essay that is about duty and responsibility to speak, about the Goldwater rule that said American mental health experts should not comment on the mental status of a political leader, someone who's not been seen as their patient, thoroughly examined. And of course, there's also the point that the essay ends on about how our tender and vulnerable feelings and places are how we can come to discover our strengths. I just wanted to kind of bring this piece about duty and responsibility into our conversation as much as we talk about the room to speak and the room to think.
That's really funny that I elided the two. I forgot. Yeah, totally. I mean, you bring up a thing that came out of my sort of lucky collaboration on Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, which was to get in contact with Robert J. Lifton, who is at 97 still writing and speaking and doing so many really erudite and fruitful generative things. He talked about being a witnessing professional, and I had a piece in Psychoanalytic Dialogues that was just asking us to be very heartfelt, and why do we do the work we do, and particularly about trans and the attack on trans rights and women's rights recently and how that impacted us. And I cited how I ended up writing, which was something that I thought that I was gonna kind of hang up my spurs with before I became an analyst, actually, because in my former life, I was a writer director and I had horrible writer's block and I just could not sort of resolve it. And I kind of threw up my hands and said, I'm gonna do something else. And I decided to become an analyst. And it was the Trump election which sent all of my sexual assault survivors who I was treating at Beth Israel into crisis. And I couldn't but get back in and write an op-ed. And I didn't really want to do it because of my own intrinsic writer's block tortures. But I did it, and it brought out, it was, you know, a version of duty to speak is that op-ed. And it's so many different things that pulled me out of my own stuckness and torture, really, around writing, which was being in a witnessing professional. So I mean, it kind of goes together, because that duty to speak was written before the Donald Trump. It kind of led to the chapter in that book, but I connected his phrase, witnessing professional, which he basically says, as mental health clinicians, as psychoanalysts, psychiatrists, psychologists, we have a duty to use our professional skills to bear witness to what we see and comment on them. And so, like, I guess I've taken it to heart before I met Lifton and after I met Lifton, in saying, like, it's a version of, you see something, say something, mm-hmm. you know, because how can you not in so many ways, particularly now? And we see a lot from a lot of different angles. I'm not trying to, like, amplify the, you know, the analyst or psychotherapist position, but we're trained to see things in a certain way. And if we see them happening and we can do something with that, then it behooves us to be that witnessing professional.
I'm really wondering how much of this thinking of yours and certain decisiveness with which you come forward with this standpoint is informed by your background in being a artist and director and screenwriter. I think that, like, that kind of, like, this kind of a transition from arts into psychoanalysis is something that is very near and dear to me and Isaac as well. And I like to think about the richness that can bring into our psychoanalytic thinking, but also ways in which different mindset can shape up certain rigidity within the discipline itself. You know, like, around questions around whether you can come out as a with your political position openly, publicly, and what will that do to your patients, and so on and so forth. How, you know, like, coming from arts, which kind of, like, has activism built in itself in a different way for much longer than psychoanalysis, you know, like, throughout at least second half of 20th century, that there is a different mind frame that you come in with.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, I can talk about it developmentally too. I was in my mid 40s when I switched into this career. And so I like to say that while certain colleagues of mine and dear friends were sort of born into psychoanalysis or believe psychoanalysis like it's their religion, for me, I'm like a bad convert. So I'm not fixed in its and I there are certain ways in which when I first started getting into understanding psychoanalysis and how there was a disenfranchisement of gay and trans and gender non-binary people and the dynamics of that, I was like, what, why? You know, and why can't we talk about politics? Politics absolutely has everything. You know, how is it just social and it's external? And how are we just focusing on the intrinsic, particularly as an Asian American? Everything that I have lived through informs, including my writer's block, this struggle to speak. You know, this is the thing that brought me to being a psychoanalyst, which was this internal conflict over expression, which is just ironic that this kind of released it in a very weird way. But like, this has everything to do with the intrinsic structure. So it didn't make any sense to me. And then as a trauma therapist, which is also something that I fell into, as Judith Herman, another one of our guests and the, you know, kind of the mother of trauma treatment, said, trauma is social. So it doesn't, you know, and it doesn't make sense not to talk about this. So that was what I was told when I entered into psychoanalytic training. And I just was like, okay, whatever. I'm a bad convert. I'm not listening to this. Sorry. Doesn't work. And you know, being full, you know, being 45 or you know, however old I wasn't a kid. My brain structure had been formed for better or for worse, and I hope it wasn't so dogmatic, but it was like, no, sorry, can't go there, you know. And you know, I don't understand, you know, like I don't want to be reductive and flippant, but I in sum, it was clear to me that in my own experience, and I had to hang on to that. Otherwise, like, you know, I wasn't, and I think being an artist, you hang on, you mine for what's in within. So that was what I was dying to have come out. So in that way, it does all come together.
Betty, is there anything that we haven't brought up today that might be important to include in this conversation?
No, I mean, like, I think there's one thing. I just finished writing something that's due to come out in psychoanalytic inquiry, and it's something that I'm really thinking about, and so therefore I'll share it here. It's really about the concept of care, and we did an interview, and it was inspired by this interview with a political scientist, Deva Woodley, who is an expert on social movements and grassroots politics, like, and how things take hold from the grassroots level and how they can really take on momentum. But not just that, how government needs the formal halls of power need grassroots movements and vice versa to really hold all that society requires. It's not just the halls of power and federal government as it stands here in the United States, it's also the streets. And there's a conversation in a way, or happening between those on the streets and those in the formal halls of power or engaging in formal politics. And she, you know, that's all really great, and everybody should read her book. It's called Reckoning on Social Movements and Black Lives Matter. She's really sharp. But her concept on the politics of care, I think, is something that I have really hooked into. And it's an intersection between psychology or our work as psychotherapists and psychoanalysts and politics. Because we can't, and this is where it comes, I'll break it down. She says with the word care, you cannot care about things if they do not matter. But because we all have matter, like substance as human beings, nobody is without substance. then we all matter, and therefore we all deserve care. And so it's a, such a, you know, beautifully simple but profound argument for equity and inclusion. And that everything we do, I think, as psychotherapists, is out of care. You know, so we're, it's an intersection of, and so she's saying governments with a politics of care should treat everybody as they are, with matter, and therefore deserving care. And that is the same as we do in our session rooms. We center the patient, no matter who they are, and they matter. We show them they may not think they matter, but we say to them they matter. We enter into all sorts of engagement and discussion and breakdowns on how they matter if they are embodied. They sometimes I have patients who don't feel embodied. And we work with them because we care. And we show them that they have matter and importance and substance, and so we care. And I just feel like it is the grounding for so much sense in the nonsense, logic in the chaos, and relational action that is not splitting. And you know, it relates to what I was saying about radical openness, taking the other into your care, you know, no matter who they are, because they have matter. And they might be spewing the most offensive things ever, but what's underneath? What's happening? So that we can get beyond this moment and truly move on, not just move on, forget you, I don't care, dismiss you. Move on together so that we can build something for the next generations that's sustainable, because right now it is not sustainable.
Thank you. Thank you, Betty, for talking with us today and for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
It's been a true pleasure.